Welcome to The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman on a Sunday morning after a slate of games that included the Iron Bowl, Friday's Notre Dame-UNC game, a great finish in the Pac-12, and of course, history was made on Saturday at Vanderbilt. But first, Bruce, I want to talk about a team that didn't play, and that is the Ohio State Buckeyes. I feel like your big noon kickoff appearances every week now are always about some team's COVID situation, but I think this one that you had to talk about on Saturday with Ohio State, of all the cancellations we've had to this point, I believe the number is now 100. This is the first one where it's like, whoa, this situation could actually affect the playoff race. If Ohio State can't play again next week, so. Where do we think Ohio State is on this? And then we'll get into the really bizarre Big Ten setup where they might miss the title game.
Right. So this was obviously a very fluid topic on Friday night, where our reporting was starting to move that the game was initially going to go from being a noon Eastern game to then to like possibly at 4 p.m. Eastern, it was going to be the kickoff. And that was, I want to say that was the discussion like Friday night. And then it was, well, if they go there and get, and they fly into Champaign and test, then if they get good results, then maybe they can play the game at 4. If not, the game's off. And then I remember making some calls to other folks in the Big Ten, and they're like, it looks like the game's going to get canceled. And I don't know, within 15 minutes, it got, from that point, it did get canceled. And then Saturday morning going in and just talking to a lot of people inside the Ohio State program, they had a bunch of cases come up. They are, I think, not that optimistic whether they will be able to play a game. It's not looking that promising against Michigan State this coming week. It's at Michigan State. They're not in their building, and their facility are not allowed in there at this point. And it's really concerning because what we've seen from a bunch of places, and I go back to in the Big Ten, Wisconsin went from one positive case to almost 30 in the program within a week. And we've seen some of that happen where you go from 2 to 7 to 15, and then all of a sudden it's a big concern. And we know... I know Ryan Day is not the only guy on the coaching staff who has tested positive. I know there are issues that they're dealing with at certain positions, especially. And we'll see. I had talked to Gene Smith, the AD, and asked him if they had no more positive cases over the weekend, which would mean they didn't test yesterday. They are actually testing Sunday as we're taping this. And he said, you know what, we don't know. Like, he didn't want to speculate on, you know, like on what this is going to look like a couple days from now because it's just at this point, he was like, it really is a day-to-day situation of where this goes. There's a lot of case, really high positive case number in the county Ohio State is in. The team doctor, Jim Borchers, answered my question as well, and he was like, you know, we're going to make a fact-based, data-driven decision on all this, but when you try to speculate and anticipate where things are going, he said that's where you get into trouble. So right now I think there's a lot of people around the Ohio State program that have their fingers crossed that this thing is not going to keep spreading the way we've seen it spread at a bunch of other places. I mean, look at what's gone on at Minnesota. I mean, it's hard to think that the Gophers are going to be playing anytime soon, where it goes from a half dozen to now it's like 40 there. It's a crazy year right now.
All right, I want to get something off my chest here. We had a little bit of a Slack channel debate about this yesterday, but So on the one hand, you could say, I mean, COVID is out of control everywhere. It's certainly, you know, the kind of places we're talking about, Ohio, Minnesota, Wisconsin earlier, are some of the worst hit. And so you could say, well, there was no getting around this. There was no avoiding it. This was going to happen, you know, regardless of all the policies they put in place. I think the Big Ten has just bungled every step of trying to play football during a pandemic. And I understand that we're all, you know, there's no rules for this. Everybody's trying to figure it out on the fly. But you contrast, I mean, after the great to-do about, okay, first we're not playing. We don't think it's safe to play. Now we are going to play. And the reason we feel safe playing is we're going to test every day. We have this magic wand, this daily antigen test, and it's going to prevent outbreaks because we'll catch the positives quickly. I mean, 40 cases in 6 days in Minnesota, or 8 days, I believe, is as much. And granted, not every school is being forthcoming about this, but we haven't heard of that kind of number in that short of time anywhere. Ohio State, Maryland, Wisconsin, they're in as bad or worse a shape than any other conference. And the difference being, if they had started earlier, like the SEC still hasn't had to, they've had outbreaks, they've had teams miss two games, and they're still, as of this moment, on track to have everybody play their full schedule because they started in late September and left enough weeks open to make up games. The Big Ten gave themselves no margin for error. They thought they'd like solved COVID. And now you're in a situation where if Ohio State can't play next week, because of the rule they put in place about the six-game minimum, your best team, everybody knows they're the best team in the Big Ten, won't be able to play for the Big Ten championship. And Wisconsin can't either. You're looking at probably a Northwestern-Indiana Big Ten title game. And honestly, if Ohio State plays Wisconsin or Iowa that weekend in like the second-place crossover game, I think more people will be interested in that game.
Yeah, and probably the CFP folks will be more interested in that game. We can talk to that about that in a second, about what would happen if Ohio State is 5-0 or 6-0 and a Big Ten champ is 8-1. You know, realistically, what the Buckeyes' hopes would be. But before we get to that, you know, what you said about the Big Ten situation, and I think one of the things that has been very problematic in this has been that, and I've talked to people within the Big Ten about this for pretty much since after that Wisconsin-Illinois opener, was there's an element of this, of the contact tracing, that has been very ambiguous. And I think that has made it harder. And I do wonder how much sharing of information and how much learning from each other's situations has gone on with this. Now, I mean, look, neither one of us is an epidemiologist, and neither one of us has complete access to all the information. Neither one of us has actually much access to the information, you know, of what's gone on behind the scenes. I mean, you're talking about Minnesota is disclosing information that, frankly, most schools in some of the conferences you're talking about are not disclosing, right?
Right. They're not, they are being fully transparent, whereas a lot of them are being transparent.
You know, it's like, so we don't know a lot what's going on behind the scenes with some of these other programs. I mean, Mississippi State has not offered a ton of detail. We've heard a little bits and pieces here and there, but, you know, I think that's the different part. Also, different parts of the country are being, you know, now obviously COVID is everywhere, but you look, if you do COVID hotspot, the upper Midwest is being hit by it especially hard right now. And that's not to say, you know, to shrug our shoulders at any of this, but I'm just looking at this thinking, if there was an issue that I would be more curious about, because a lot of times you hear, well, there's privacy issues, and I get that. But also, you're not talking about disclosing the names of specific people in this case. I think you're talking about how much information did some of these schools within conferences share? Because it seems like there has been a disconnect, and it doesn't seem like it's been a very beneficial thing that there's been that disconnect.
I was on this cause in like July. As soon as the team started reporting back, and it became apparent that they were going to treat just a lot of these schools are going to treat COVID numbers the way they treat like ankle sprains and hide it from the media. I mean, I was concerned enough to reach out to the conferences and eventually send a letter along with a bunch of other media organizations, and it didn't get anywhere. They clearly weren't going to stand up to them. And this is why. I mean, look at what happened with Clemson and Florida State. You know, there's been all these situations now where there's gamesmanship or there's threats of gamesmanship. And, you know, Ohio State, Gene Smith said on Saturday that he says we could have played. It wasn't the right thing to do. What does that mean? Where, you know, if you told us the numbers, maybe we would have a better sense of should they have played that game or not played that game. Did they do a disservice to Illinois by not playing the game, or was it truly at a point where, oh yeah, if we knew those numbers, we'd say, yeah, it's definitely good they didn't play. I mean, look at this compared to the NFL with the Broncos situation, with the Ravens situation. We know exactly how many guys have tested positive. We know exactly what's driving their decisions, good or bad. I don't agree with all of them. I don't think the Broncos should have to play with no quarterbacks. You know, the conferences in college at least have a minimum on that. But at least we know what's driving the decision-making. We have no idea in college. Anyway, a little bit of a rant, but I do think that, you know, I think it's worth holding the Big Ten accountable for just some of these very, very flawed decisions they made along the way. All right, to the football part of it. Let's say Ohio State can't play Michigan State this week. Their best case scenario at that point is to go 6-0 with a win over Indiana, who's ranked in the top 15, and, you know, assuming they would play Wisconsin or Iowa, maybe that team's ranked in the top 20, and then everybody else they played with a losing record. I think there's been this assumption all along that, well, Ohio State was a preseason top three team. They have Justin Fields. They blew out the first few teams they played. Like, if they go undefeated, they're going to go to the playoff. I'm not so sure about that anymore. And it's not because of the number of games, because, I mean, I think the committee made it clear on Tuesday night that that's, you know, they're not really, if they think you're one of the four best teams, you're one of the four best teams. The question is, will they play enough quality teams to make that case? Because I've got to tell you, if Notre Dame loses to Clemson, they'll have a loss, but they'll be 11-1. They will have beaten Clemson. They had a great win this weekend at a top 20 UNC team to completely shut down their offense. Like, they'll just flat out have a better resume than Ohio State, even with the one loss.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, look, I think we come back to this, and maybe you kind of look at your expectations on what the season was going to be. We knew it was going to be a crazy year going into this in the fall. I think that it's going to be more of a beauty contest than ever. There's more kinds of things that are just, you're just going to shrug your shoulders at it. I mean, I think for a lot of fans, what I would say with this is, again, and I don't want to say, like, you know, prepare for the worst as it comes to how this is going to play out, but you know, it's just not a normal year, and there's all kinds of things that people are making adjustments for, and I don't know how. I mean, the committee never has an easy job with this, but I just think this is a specific case where you're not going to be able to, you know, I don't even know what more to say about it, really, because I just think it's, you're looking at some teams have played three games and some teams have played, you know, Texas State has played 12. It's just such a bizarre year. And this is what you were going to, this is what everybody kind of signed up for.
Yeah. Look at a team like Washington. They're now 3-0. They weren't ranked by the committee last week. I assume they'll move in there this week, but like if they had started playing 2 weeks earlier, maybe they would be considered a playoff contender. You know, maybe they'd be 5-0 and they'd be ranked where Northwestern was last week or something like that. It's as it is now, it feels like, I don't want to say the playoff race is anticlimactic, but at this point, I think it's maybe like five teams competing for four spots. It's not a very long list, because I think Alabama, I would be surprised if they're not the number one seed. I'm not saying Florida can't beat them, but Alabama is a machine. They're the team. You know, they are now the team you thought they could be coming into the season. I think the Ole Miss game gave us pause, but their defense has come, you know, looks like a championship defense now, completely suffocated Auburn, and obviously their offense is unbelievable. Like I said, I think Notre Dame should be there. I think if Clemson beats Notre Dame, they're there. And then what? And then Ohio State or Florida if they beat Alabama.
So what? So let me spin this to you. So what happens if Florida's going to play Alabama? Alabama beats them. Well, they beat them by 7 points or 27 points. They beat them. So now you have a Florida team with two losses, including one to Texas A&M. Texas A&M, I think you and I both watched that game against LSU. It was in sloppy conditions. Their offense did not look good at all. I mean, they played a team with two true freshman quarterbacks that were struggling. And honestly, you know, the difference was Texas A&M's defense was better than LSU's defense. But LSU's defense has been awful this year. I mean, I get it. Texas A&M hadn't played a football game in a while, too. You know, based on the head-to-head element of them beating Florida, it's, and they both have one loss, it's hard for me, just on principle, to bump Florida above them, given the head-to-head. But I don't. And look, if Florida has two losses, I definitely wouldn't, you know, have them ahead of an A&M team that has one, even though it would have played a less game. But what are you sitting out there looking at as saying, here's the fourth best team then?
Yeah, A&M really complicates things because I don't believe they're a top five team. I'm not sure they're even a top 10 team, but they beat Florida. And, you know, there's kind of a that's always been a bit of a, you go back to the first year of the playoff when TCU lost to Baylor like 61-58 and stayed ahead of them up until the last weekend. And then on the very last weekend, they moved Baylor in front of them. They both missed the playoff, but they moved Baylor in front of them. I think there's this notion that, you know, if there's a head-to-head result, you have to honor the head-to-head result. But they're very inconsistent about that. I mean, Iowa State beat Oklahoma. Should they be – why are they behind Oklahoma? If you think there's a – and maybe they don't. Maybe they don't think there's any sort of gap between Florida and A&M, but I do. And so given that, a three-point win at home, to me, should not override the entire seasons for those two teams. I would not have them kind of attached at the hip like that, but I understand why people do. And so it's very hard for me to see, I mean, A&M beating out Ohio State or beating out Notre Dame. But like you said, if Florida's out of the picture, suddenly that becomes a real possibility.
So who are you sticking in there? Are you sticking Cincinnati in there?
I mean, for now, I'll still say Ohio State. But we don't know, you know, there's still a lot of football to be played, as they say. We don't know what, like, is Ohio State going to come back when they finally start playing again, whether that's next week or man's Michigan, you know, are they going to come out looking like a top four team? Because the last time we saw them, Justin Fields threw three interceptions and their defense gave up almost 500 passing yards to Indiana. And that led to some questions. And you could say, well, you know, they've got time to get better. Now they don't have a lot of time to get better, so I don't know. I do think there's a window there for Cincinnati, but it's kind of a I'll believe it when I see it thing. I mean, the committee respected them enough to put them number seven, higher than any group of five teams so far. But it's, you know, two wins down the stretch against Tulsa, who they have in the top 25, but barely in the top 25. Like, is that going to be enough to pass Ohio State, undefeated Ohio State, even at a 6-0? I don't think so.
All right, Stu, let's get into some stories that aren't related to the playoff and quite honestly are maybe more feel-good stories. The first one I want to get to is this is obviously a quarterback-dominated year, as it usually is, but for the Heisman. But this week I stuck in our straw poll at The Athletic, I stuck a non-quarterback in there, and that is Buffalo's Jarrett Patterson, who for the second week in a row has run wild, eight touchdowns. I mean, he has 12 touchdowns and like 700 rushing yards in the last two games. I mean, it's amazing what he has done for Buffalo. Were you watching that game?
Absolutely. I mean, that window didn't have a lot else going for it in the first place, but as you started to see on Twitter, he's up to three touchdowns, he's up to four touchdowns. how could you not turn over to that and watch that? And I gotta say, if he's not an NFL running back, I don't know who is. I mean, he's, I don't care. Kent State's actually not bad. They're a decent MAC team. Doesn't he remind you of like an old school, you know, like the kind of running backs we watched growing up, where he's just like, he bounces off people. He has great vision. Once he finds a seam, he's gone. What he's doing is unbelievable. He's the first player to run for 300 yards in back-to-back games since Ricky Williams in 98. Now, I think it's, you know, unfortunate for him that they didn't start playing till November. They're playing a six-game season. You know, he's just not going to get the opportunities that, like Zach Wilson. You know, Zach Wilson's been playing since Labor Day, and he's on ESPN all the time, and everybody's seen him play. You know, that he's just getting more mainstream exposure than Patterson. Though certainly, I believe he was the second story on SportsCenter on Saturday night. People certainly took notice of 409 yards. How crazy was it at the end, by the way, when he got pulled? He could have broken Samaje Perine's record. He could have broken the, gotten to 9 touchdowns and broken that record. His coach just didn't know that that's where it stood.
I'll be honest, I forgot Samaje Perine had that record. Obviously, I knew he was a really productive back at OU, but I forgot that he had that game, you know.
Kansas, remember, right?
Yeah, so.
Well, what was really crazy about that season was 2014 is that Melvin Gordon broke the record the week before. Like, first Melvin Gordon went for 400, and then, and we all, you know, were in awe of that, and then like a week later, Samaje Perine topped it.
Yes, and then the other story that was very significant came out of Vanderbilt, and it was one I think we had all started to kind of hear was going in that direction, and our colleagues Joe Rexford and Chris Kamrani did a good advance of it, with Sarah Fuller becoming the first female to actually play in a Power 5 football game. And it's, the circumstances are obviously, everything in the circumstances are pretty bizarre this year, but certainly you had somebody from an SEC championship soccer team end up playing college football. And I thought Derek Mason, look, it's been a dismal year for Vandy football, and it was a otherwise dreadful day for the Commodores, but there was, you know, a ray of positivity out of that.
It's a really cool moment that obviously anybody can appreciate. But, you know, Bruce, we both have young daughters, and I can't say that I would have reacted exactly the same 6 years ago to this as I did on Saturday. I mean, I took the video of it and ran downstairs to show my daughter, who's 4. And, you know, she doesn't quite understand it. She doesn't fully realize that girls don't usually play football. But I love the fact that she and lots of, you know, and Sarah Fuller herself, who I think is, for having been thrown into this in 6 days warning, I mean, she's doing all those interviews Saturday night. She's on with Linda Cohn, and you can tell she fully embraces and understands like what this moment meant for young girls everywhere. And it's really cool to see the Mia Hamms and Alex Morgan and you name it, right? All of these great female athletes suddenly know who she is and are tweeting about her and everything. So it was really cool. For all the people who are critiquing her squib kick on Twitter, give me a break. You're not a special teams coach. You don't know what exactly she was asked to do there. I think she pretty much did exactly what they asked her to do. And I got to think, kicking a squib kick and placing it in the right spot is probably a lot harder than like making an extra point. I don't know for sure, but there's definitely some skill involved there that, you know, only she could do because she has the soccer background.
Yeah. As you said, very, very cool moment, especially impacting as I'm sure it will for probably lots of young girls who never were going to pay attention to Vanderbilt football on that Saturday, given where they were. And I just think that one was probably a lot bigger takeaway. And I think people will remember that going forward.
I did want to get to a game that happened on Friday, Iowa State, Texas. If you watch this game, it was kind of the Tom Herman era in a nutshell. Texas had the lead, had the chance, a couple chances to put the game away. Some decisions backfired in terms of going for it on fourth and one and not getting it, and a fake punt that they didn't get. Iowa State comes back and wins, and it really is swung. I mean, the whole Big 12 title race. If Texas holds on and wins that game, they control their destiny to get to the title game and probably play Oklahoma. But now Iowa State wins. Iowa State is basically a near lock at this point. They only have one game left to get in there. And Texas is 5-3. And the pressure that was already mounting on Tom Herman, I think you would say, oh, how can one game decide a guy's fate? But just I think the way it played out, the significant or the symbol that it is that Iowa State has passed Texas as a program, basically. And then, you know, they asked Sam Ellinger afterward about, hey, you know, is this the mistakes and the lack of discipline? Is this coaching? And at first he kind of defended his coaches, but then he said, you know, Sam Ellinger, local kid, grew up rooting for Texas. He said, that's the million-dollar question that people have been asking for 10 years here. That was not exactly a ringing endorsement of the coach.
Yeah, at this point, you know, Tom had – he's been there 4 years. This is basically towards the end of his fourth season. And I just think it's been a very underwhelming tenure there. We've talked about this a bunch on the podcast, especially over the last year. But I remember I come back to – we did a game before they played TCU, and you could feel from talking to people around the program that there was a lot of people who were kind of over him, just felt like it was not working out. They ended up losing that game. They had been really bad on defense, and the offense had been carrying it in that game. Ellinger got picked off four times, and it just – you know, it's not like the Big 12 is loaded right now. I mean, Oklahoma had been struggling this year. Now it seems like they've gotten it back on track. But this isn't the SEC West they're in. And I think certainly it's not helping because recruiting keeps backsliding under him. And, you know, there's been some moments, too, where it's not always been the, you know, there's been, it's weird to say a head coach can have some immature moments, but I think with Tom there have been a few of those where you just kind of probably scratched your head and go, that's, you know, you could probably do that at some other place. You usually can't do that as if you're the Texas head coach. And in some ways I feel like, you know, Jim Harbaugh and Michigan's issues have kind of cloaked a little bit of what's gone on at Texas. Right. I mean, there was a good second year where they finished ninth in the country. But beyond that, it's kind of been a dud. And now they're to buy him out. It's over $15 million. And the staff piece not doesn't double it, but it puts it well over $20 million. And then what do you do? I mean, this is something I'm writing about for The Athletic for Monday. Is obviously there's an elephant in the room, and it's his old boss, Urban Meyer. The issue is going to be, does Urban Meyer really want to come back to coaching? And we'll get into that a little bit in the column. But I think if you're Texas, I think you look at it and say, who do we feel, if it's not Urban Meyer, who would we want and feel comfortable feeling like this guy's going to get it done here? Now, the guy who just beat you, Matt Campbell, would be to me, a no-brainer if he really wants that job. After that, I don't know. You know, it's a little like the Michigan job where it's like, you better have somebody really good to take over. But I think it's going to be harder and harder for Tom Herman to stay there, just because it's not helping him that Texas A&M has ascended under Jimbo Fisher, same amount of time. And it's, you know, it's hard, I think, for recruits to buy in when they look at it as your head coach is, it's going to feel like Clay Helton all over again if they don't make a change, because he just blew up his staff last year.
It's getting really hard to see how he could be back. And you could say, if you're looking just at the price tag, you'd say that's prohibitive, that's ridiculous. You know, if they go 7-3, what's the real shame of that? But like you said, there's just all the there's no, that program just has nothing really going for it right now. And I think that probably the most telling thing in this whole year is that you have the number one quarterback recruit in the country in your backyard. He initially does commit to Texas. Wow, what a win for Tom Herman. Great sign for the future. And then he decommits and he's going to, of all schools, Ohio State, where Herman came from or once was. You know, if you are going to try to go get Urban Meyer, is he going to be trying to re-recruit that kid for Texas? It's just a mess. But anyway.
And keep in mind, that kid is actually not for next year. He's a 2022
kid. Yeah. I mean, and Sam Ellinger is going to go down as one of the most popular players to ever play for Texas, and he's a four-year starter. And it's kind of like, this is the best you could do. They had one Sugar Bowl win over Georgia. Congrats. You almost beat, or you came close against LSU the year they won the national title. At the end of the day, he's 9-7 in the Big 12 since last season. Just doesn't cut it. So, I think if Cristel, and by the way, everybody around there is like, yeah, the relationship between Cristel Conte and Tom Herman is really frosty right now. So, yeah, I don't see it how he's back next year. But I'm with you. It's like you've got all your eggs on Urban Meyer. And I don't know. You work with the guy every week. What do you think? Is he eyeing a return?
You're going to have to read the columns too.
Okay. Well, that's a good tease. People can sign up for the Black Friday sale we have right now, $1 a month for 12 months, and read that column.
Who would you want, Stu? If you can't have him.
If you can't have him, I think it becomes like a wrestling match with Michigan possibly for Matt Campbell. I kind of don't see Matt Campbell leaving for another job within his own conference. I could be wrong, but that doesn't seem like something he would do. I could more see him going to Michigan in the part of the country he really knows. But there is no obvious plan B at Texas. There really isn't. I know some say people will say Bob Stoops. I don't see that happening. It just feels like it needs to be a big name because the last two hires, everybody respected Charlie Strong when they hired Charlie Strong. That seemed like a perfectly good hire. That didn't work out. Tom Herman, they were basically in a bidding war with LSU. The guy was so popular. That's not working out. Like, it almost is the point where you have to have a guy who has Power 5 head coaching experience in there. That's not an obvious list.
No, I mean, and again, this is some stuff I'll be writing about for Monday, so I'll probably save some of that for the column.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We got a whole bunch this week. The first one is from David in Los Gatos, not very far from where I am right now. Bama seems real comfortable having Sark run the show versus other teams, making a big deal that the head coach was working via Zoom. Is Sark at the place of being the heir in waiting for Bama once Nick Saban retires?
I think he might be. And that may shock some USC fans, but I know people there have been very impressed with him. Look, and I think we've seen some similar parallels with people promoting from within for continuity's sake, whether it's Lincoln Riley in Oklahoma or Ryan Day, certainly at Ohio State. And at certainly yesterday's Iron Bowl, I think, didn't hurt his cause at all. So Nick Saban's been pretty effusive of him. Now, look, if Dabo Swinney made it known that he wanted that job, I think that would certainly throw a monkey wrench in that. But again, like what we just talked about with Texas and like we've talked about Michigan, it's not like there's easy answers for these. Now, obviously, Alabama has tons of resources and everything a coach could want to be successful. But again, it's a big job, and sometimes the guy who has seen it on the inside is probably the easiest hire to make.
I think that he's really gone underappreciated in terms of the impact he's had on that offense, because they just have so many great players that maybe it's not obvious like how the offense has changed since Josh Gattis was there, or who was before
Josh
him?
Josh Gattis. You mean Kiffin? Mike Locksley?
Oh, wait.
Brian
I'm getting
Daboll?
I'm getting my chronology mixed up here. Went Brian Daboll, then Loxley. Oh, Gattis was never actually the OC, was he? That's why he left.
He was a co-coordinator. Yeah.
Maybe people don't fully appreciate that, you know, that the offense has changed. But if you watch Mac Jones, like, how did Mac Jones go from throwing two pick sixes in the Iron Bowl last year to throwing five touchdowns this year and looking great? I do think a part of it is the play designs, because everybody knows that he's going to be trying to throw to Devontae Smith, and yet Devontae Smith gets wide open. And a lot of that is the way the plays are designed, where there was one touchdown where everybody watching, and certainly Auburn's defense, thought he was about to throw a screen pass, and then pump fake, Devontae Smith, gone. It's, you know, I think that he's left his stamp on it, and that should make him attractive to not just Saban, but I mean, I guess if we're saying he's qualified enough to be the next Alabama head coach, then why wouldn't we just say that's who Texas should hire?
I think that's a bigger... Texas doesn't know him the way the people inside the Alabama program know him, at this point. I think he knows everything that's gone on there at the, you know, how they've built it in Tuscaloosa, how they've elevated it. I think it's different when you're talking about having to really change a culture of what they have to do. It's not set in place. You may not be able to bring some of the same people. I think it's not as seamless, right? It's more of a gamble if you're Michigan or if you're Texas to go hire Steve Sarkisian. Now, look, I think everything I've heard from people I trust down there is that Steve Sarkisian has really grown and continued to evolve, certainly from the guy whose life was in a different place when he was at USC and even at Washington. But having said those things, when he was a head coach at those places, it wasn't like he was, you know, had Chris Peterson's, you know, record. That I think that there's still some uncertainty on how he's going to do if he is in the big chair at a place like that, right? So I think that's part of why I think there's, you know, some guys are better fits at certain places than they would be. You know, we think Matt Campbell would probably win anywhere he went. I'm not sure that every guy is always that way. Every coach, some guys fit in certain places, and then maybe they're, just the situations are just very different. Next question I want to get to is, I think, right in your wheelhouse. This is from Rob Daniels in Greensboro. Stu and Bruce, the Pinstripe Bowl, a successful game backed by the richest team in Major League Baseball, recently announced it's taking the year off. Will that decision be a trendsetter in 2020? Should it be?
I do think there will be more games canceled. I think like most things in the pandemic, it'll vary by parts of the country, right? I mean, I'm in a county that just basically outlawed pro and college sports for 3 weeks or 4 weeks yesterday. In Santa Clara County, other parts of the country, at the very same time they did that, in other parts of the country, they're having football games and 25,000 people are coming. I'm not saying one's right or wrong, it's just different approaches. So, you know, I think the games that are going to have the hardest time are, you know, I know there's a new bowl in LA that's supposed to happen. The Vegas Bowl is still in limbo. Pinstripe is gone. Like, I can't tell you right now these specific bowls will get canceled, but I do think there will be more. I mean some of these bowls, it's just gonna lose money to stage a game with no fans in the stands. The Sun Bowl in El Paso, I guess I would bring up, just because that's been one of the worst hit places in the whole country. Are they gonna want to host a football game on New Year's Eve? And then the question I have that nobody, we just don't know the answer to this yet, but I mean, you see where players are opting out with three games left in the season because they just don't want to do this anymore. Are there teams that are going to opt out and say, yeah, I think we're ready to be done. Yeah, this wasn't a great season. We can go to a bowl, but this wasn't the most amazing season, and we're really tired of having to test everybody all week, and we don't want to do it for another 3 weeks, and so we're just going to shut it down for the season. Like, that could definitely happen. And then, you know, that could have a ripple effect. I know everybody's eligible, but at some point you would say, yeah, we're not going to host a bowl game this year if we have to have like a 4-7 team against a 4-4 team.
If you were a betting man, what percentage of the 70 plus bowl games do you think actually end up happening this winter?
Bruce, there are not 70 bowl games. I've actually lost track of how many there are left at this point. I think 35. Okay. I would say like 75% get played. I mean,
okay,
like the Alamo Bowl will get played. You know, lots of these, the one in Orlando that's now the Cheez-It Bowl will get played. Like, you know, lots of these decent bowls will get played. And then some of them, like, let's not forget, some of these are ESPN-owned bowls that exist for one reason and one reason only, to be a 3.5-hour block of television programming on ESPN. Most of those bowls will get played. I think it's the ones that don't have that incentive, that actually need to make money to stay in business for another year, that might be in trouble. By the way, in your own, I mean, this is one I'm wondering about. You know, much like where I am, your county has been starting to do some, I wouldn't call them lockdowns, but some restrictions. Like, what if they can't play the Rose Bowl, the college football playoff semifinal at the Rose Bowl?
Yeah, that obviously is, I don't know if that's been kicked around at all by the CFP people. I don't know if that's, you know, I would like to think that they would have the foresight to go, that could be problematic. I know that, you know, look, I don't follow the bowl dynamics the way you do, but if you're ESPN, who's obviously heavily invested in that, and if you're, you know, you got to talk to the, be in constant communication, I think, with like the people who put on the Rose Bowl and the Tournament of Roses, because they have to be well versed in what's going on in their community to relay it back. So even if the CFP people directly, and when I think of the CFP, I think of, you know, Bill Hancock and the people who we see on Tuesday nights, but I think the people who are behind the scenes have to be more plugged into those realities right now, because look, this is as fluid a situation as you know, like, just personally, I haven't noticed, living in Los Angeles, I haven't noticed a difference in the last, you know, this week compared to the last month. But I certainly know the cases and the hospitalizations are up, you know, in a lot of places. And, you know, you just got to keep your fingers crossed that we can, you know, not to go off track here, but like, you hear that a vaccine is coming very, very soon, or a couple of vaccines. So hopefully, you know, we can keep treading water on this till then.
Yeah, I
through that point,
I would hope they have a contingency plan. I don't know if they do, but if the Rose Bowl can't happen, they could probably go get, you know, AT&T Stadium or somewhere just to host a semifinal that's not necessarily a bowl game. But I don't think
they're not going to be fans there either way,
right?
You know,
and it's different. Yeah, go ahead.
For as much as the optics from a television broadcast standpoint, I mean, maybe this is sacrilegious to say this, but it's 2020. It's like, the main thing is the game right now. You're not going to have fans in the stands. Nobody's going to be talking about the sunset at you know, in the third quarter or the beginning of the fourth quarter in Pasadena. I mean, it's just not this year. And the main thing is going to be the game. So wherever they can have the game, if they can do it safely, then I think that's probably going to be the first order of business.
Yeah, I mean, I would just finish with one thought that I've tried to express a couple times. But, you know, people keep saying, this is the year they should expand the playoff. You know, like, if any year you're going to I can't emphasize enough how much the people across the sport just want to get to the finish line. They don't want to extend the season. They don't want to, you know, add anything that might make it even harder to finish the season. They just want to get it done by January 11th. And if that means moving a game somewhere, so be it. So I hope we don't have to get to that, because I love the Rose Bowl and I do want to see the sunset in the third quarter. But it's certainly something, I mean, you said, you know, they should stay in touch and know what's going on in the community. I can tell you this, the 49ers and Stanford and San Jose State had zero warning that there was going to be a order on Saturday that they basically have to, I mean, the 49ers have to move their whole operation to Arizona, it sounds like. Stanford's still trying to figure out what to do. They just got hit with this. So, you know, that could happen if the cases get really bad in LA, or even worse. You might not have much warning that you can't host a bowl game, but hopefully we won't get to that. Here's another coaching candidate story from Aaron, or question. Aaron Martin in Pittsburgh. Hi, Stu and Bruce. Big fan of the pod. My Golden Flashes played in their biggest game in nearly a decade on Saturday, losing a shootout to Buffalo. With fewer jobs expected to open up this cycle, is there a better chance Sean Lewis will stay in Northeast Ohio for at least one more season?
There's a decent chance of that. I know he's been on some folks' radar. He's still a young coach, and obviously they've gotten a lot better under him. I just think because the carousel is not going to be that hot. If you're South Carolina, I think, you know, he's definitely on your radar, but I don't know. I mean, we'll see what happens. If Illinois were to come open, if you're Illinois, do you try to look and get a young, hot coach who is basically in the same footprint now? I think he would be a real strong candidate for that if it were to come open. But as he said, we don't anticipate it's going to be that busy of a year, but maybe there'll be some dominoes that'll start to topple over that could cause a little bit more activity.
Yeah, Illinois would make a lot of sense. I don't know if that's going to come open. Is Syracuse going to stick with Dino Babers? It's just gotten so bad there. I can't believe they lost the game when the quarterback spiked it on fourth down. Maybe that's one where, you know, it's not like Texas, right? There's not so much backlash and pressure that
it's a basketball school.
If you keep the football coach for another year, nobody's going to be storming the streets. But like that one's bad. And then Virginia Tech is kind of coming into being a possibility. So I thought early in the year, we won't have the normal coaching carousel. But when South Carolina fired Muschamp in the middle of the season, it was like, nope, we're still going to fire coaches and pay lots of big buyouts because people don't want to, if they know things are going bad, they don't want to stick around. They don't want to put up with it for another year because it's college football and we're all just a little bit crazy.
On the last question, I want to add, so this is questions from Ben in Charlotte, North Carolina. Since you brought it up, Stu, and you mentioned Justin Fuente and Virginia Tech, as he says, things are getting bad in Blacksburg if there's an opening, and I think there's a big if because that's not going to be cheap to get rid of Justin Fuente. Any potential candidates, who would you like to see there, Stu, if it's not him?
Well, do you think they would get in on the Hugh Freeze bidding war?
I don't think they would. Now, obviously, he's in the state now. I just don't see Hugh Freeze as a connection to the Virginia Tech fan base. I don't see them going in that direction. I could be totally wrong, but I think Hugh Freeze is an SEC head coach, and I think he will be an SEC head coach either this year or next year.
I mean, I got to think somebody, if we do have a robust coaching carousel, and look, if Michigan and Texas both have openings, that's about as robust a coaching carousel as you could get. Throw Virginia Tech in there, really good job. I got to think somebody's going to hire Luke Fickell. I know that he's been, he turned down Michigan State. We don't think he would go to Michigan. But, I mean, the guy is on the cusp of taking Cincinnati to possibly the playoff, but at the very least a New Year's Six Bowl and a really good record and a top 10 ranking. I mean, it would just really surprise me if a school like Virginia Tech does have an opening and doesn't call him. I think that would be a good hire.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if I'm them, that could be a spot where I would go hard at the two Clemson coordinators. Offensively, Tony Elliott's one. Tony Elliott, from my reporting, South Carolina wondered if he was interested, and he was not. But obviously that's the arch rival of his alma mater in Clemson. Virginia Tech is not that. And certainly, Brent Venables, the defense coordinator, who's done a marvelous job there, he's been choosy on what he's wanted to pursue or not. If I'm Virginia Tech, I would definitely ask. I'll be honest. I mean, this is going to be in my column on Monday because he was at Texas because he's a really good recruiter. If I was Texas, I would actually think about Brent Venables. I know he's never been a head coach before, but he's been in that conference. He's really good recruiter. He's really good on that side of the ball. That's one guy who has never been a head coach who I would, if I was Texas, I would at least look into.
You like to put me on the spot a lot on this podcast. I'm going to turn the tables on you. Tell me right now, you're a betting man. Michigan, Texas, Virginia Tech, and South Carolina are all come open. You're a betting man. Who are the coaches at those schools in 2021?
For South Carolina, I could see them hiring Shane Beamer. A lot of the former players want him. He's got ties to the school. Economically, I think it makes some sense to them. I think he could bring some high-end coordinators that they could make the would work financially, because I don't think he would command a big price. Michigan, I think Michigan may hold firm on Jim Harbaugh. I don't think it's a slam dunk.
How is that even remotely possible?
Because first of all, you have a president who doesn't look at college football the same way as most of the presidents do. I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between him and his AD on that front. But I don't know. I think they may look at 2020 in college football as a wash, and then just say, all right, we're going to roll into 2021. He's under contract, and play this out.
That's the thing that like, if he had 3 years left on his contract, I could absolutely see, like you just said, like, that president doesn't want to make a coaching change. He doesn't, you know, I don't even think he cares. But you can't, can he really go into next season on the last year of his contract? You know, so to say, like, I think they'll stick with him, I think would have to involve giving him a contract extension on the heels of like a 3-6 season.
Why?
Because
you're just killing your recruiting
class.
You think so, but right now they're number 9 in the country according to 247 in recruiting.
Next year is not like they're class.
Yes, in 2020.
No. I'm saying, let's say he comes back next year, but with no time left on his contract. Kids are going to commit to a coach whose contract is up before they're even going to sign.
Stu, I think one thing that's different now with a one-time transfer exemption coming through, I think there could be schools that are going to go, you know what? We're not going to sign close to a full class. We might sign 15 to 25.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't think that, just from a little bit of digging around, I don't think that part of it is prohibitive as most people are inclined to think it usually is. Again, it would not at all surprise me if they parted ways with Harbaugh. But just being asked of who do I think would be there, I don't know.
Do you buy into, you know, if you watch that game, Mike Golic several times, and remember the Lions fired their coach during this game, said he thinks, you know, NFL teams are going to come after him. I mean, Golic made it seem like it'll be Harbaugh's choice. Do I want to go to the NFL or do I want to stay at Michigan? I don't know if it's that clear, but, you know, would NFL teams seeing what's going on there and figuring like, well, if he's going to jump, this would be the time, are going to pursue him?
Yeah, that would be interesting. How would, you know, if the Lions were to hire Jim Harbaugh? I don't know. I mean,
it doesn't necessarily have to be the Lions.
No, it doesn't, but I don't know. I mean, he obviously had, it didn't finish great with the Niners, but he got it turned around in a hurry. So I don't know. I feel like as much as we try not to talk about Harbaugh all the time,
there's no escaping it.
Yeah, so.
But all right, well, you didn't finish my little game.
I'll escape the rest of that.
I'll give you a pass. By the way, last week we talked about, somebody asked about Pete Carroll, and is he actually a better coach all time than Nick Saban because he won a national championship Super Bowl. Steve in Rocky River, Ohio mentions that we forgot to mention there's one other coach who's won both a college football national championship and a Super Bowl, Barry Switzer.
Yeah, shame on us. It's definitely shame on me.
So Barry Switzer, Jimmy Johnson, Pete Carroll.
As always, send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We will see you next time.